Greetings, listeners. We're back once again to talk to you about the Cthulhu mythos, its books, its monsters, its unfortunate human casualties, its timeline in general, and even its tangential bits like the dreamlands, or things of a weird nature, or things that are Lovecraftian leaning. Weird fiction, science fiction, horror, learn of terrible meetings in lonely places, of cyclopean ruins and vast staircases that lead down to abysses of nighted secrets, of complex angles that lead through invisible walls to other regions of space and time, and of hideous explorations in remote and forbidden places, on other worlds, and in different time-space continua. From the creation of our galaxy to the death of the sun, this is an exploration of the Cthulhu mythos from the perspective of humans' concept of history. We are the people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos. You can find us at pgttcm.com, pgttcm.podbean.com, and you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. The people's guide to the Cthulhu mythos starts now.
The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. Season 8.
Greetings and welcome to The People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos. I am your host, D.B. Spitzer. And between episodes, let's see, 107 and 134, we will be talking about The Beetle. The Beetle, a Mystery, is a 1897 horror novel by British writer Richard Marsh. To tell you about it is to spoil it. So check it out, and that'll be going on from now until sometime in December. This episode is brought to you by FoundOutOnClothing.com and BunnySlippers.com. Subscribe to PGTTCM with D.B. Spitzer and Seraphie. Wherever you subscribe to podcasts, we prefer Podbean and Apple Podcasts. Check out the new website over at pgttcm.com and check out the merch table over at pgttcm.threadless.com. Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at pgttcm, or check us out on YouTube at People's Guide to the Cthulhu Mythos, edited by Daniel Spitzer. Music by Kevin MacLeod, featuring The Hive, Ghost Story, Ghost Processional, Oppressive Gloom, and our theme song, The Chamber.
Chapter 38, The Rest of the Find. It was a woman's clothing, beyond a doubt, all thrown in anyhow, as if the person who had placed it there had been in a desperate hurry. An entire outfit was there, shoes, stockings, body linen, corsets and all, even to hat, gloves, and hairpins. These latter were mixed up with the rest of the garments in strange confusion. It seemed plain that whoever had worn those clothes had been stripped to the skin. Lessingham and Sidney stared at me in silence as I dragged them out and laid them on the floor. The dress was at the bottom. It was an alpaca, of a pretty shade in blue, bedecked with lace and ribbons, as is the fashion of the hour, and lined with sea-green silk. It had perhaps been a charming confection once, and that a very recent one. But now it was all soiled and creased and torn and tumbled. The two spectators made a simultaneous pounce at it as I brought it into the light. "My God," cried Sidney, "it's Marjorie's. She was wearing it when I saw her last." "It's Marjorie's," gasped Lessingham. He was clutching at the ruined costume, staring at it like a man who has just received sentence of death. "She wore it when she was with me yesterday. I told her how it suited her and how pretty she was." There was silence. It was an eloquent find. It spoke for itself. The two men gazed at the heap of feminine glories. It might have been the most wonderful sight they ever had seen. Lessingham was the first to speak. His face had all at once grown gray and haggard. "What has happened to her?" I replied to his question with another. "Are you sure this is Miss Linden's dress?" "I am sure. And were proof needed, here it is." He had found the pocket and was turning out the contents. There was a purse which contained money and some visiting cards on which were her name and address, a small bunch of keys with her nameplate attached, a handkerchief with her initials in a corner. The question of ownership was placed beyond a doubt. "You see," said Lessingham, exhibiting the money which was in the purse, "it is not robbery which has been attempted. Here are 2 £10 notes, and 1 for 5, besides gold and silver. Over 30 pounds in all." Atherton, who had been turning over the accumulation of rubbish between the joists, proclaimed another find. "Here are her rings, and watch, and a bracelet. No, it certainly does not look as if theft had been an object." Lessingham was glowering at him with knitted brows. "I have to thank you for this." Sidney was unwontedly meek. "You are hard on me, Lessingham, harder than I deserve. I had rather have thrown away my own life than have suffered misadventure to have come to her." "Yours are idle words. Had you not meddled, this would not have happened. A fool works more mischief with his folly than of malice prepense. If hurt has befallen Marjorie Linden, you shall account for it to me with your life's blood." "Let it be so," said Sidney. "I am content. If hurt has come to Marjorie, God knows that I am willing enough that death should come to me." While they wrangled, I continued to search. A little to one side, under the flooring, which was still intact, I saw something gleam. By stretching out my hand, I could just manage to reach it. There was a long plait of woman's hair. It had been cut off at the roots, so close to the head in one place that the scalp itself had been cut, so the hair was clotted with blood. They were so occupied with each other that they took no notice of me. I had to call their attention to my discovery. "Gentlemen, I fear that I have here something which will distress you. Is not this Miss Linden's hair?" They recognized it on the instant. Lessingham, snatching it from my hands, pressed it to his lips. "This is mine. I shall at least have something." He spoke with a grimness which was a little startling. He held the silken tresses at arm's length. "This points to murder, foul, cruel, causeless murder. As I live, I will devote my all, money, time, reputation, to gaining vengeance on the wretch who did this deed." Atherton chimed in. "To that I say amen." He lifted his hand. "God is my witness." "It seems to me, gentlemen, that we move too fast. To my mind, it does not by any means of necessity point to murder. On the contrary, I doubt if murder has been done. Indeed, I don't mind owning that I have a theory of my own which points all the other way." Lessingham caught me by the sleeve. "Mr. Champnell, tell me your theory." "I will, a little later. Of course, it may be altogether wrong, though I fancy it is not. I will explain my reasons when we come to talk of it, but at present there are things which must be done." "I vote for tearing up every board in the house," cried Sidney, "and for pulling the whole infernal place to pieces. It's a conjurer's den. I shouldn't be surprised if Cabby's old gent is staring at us all the while from some peephole of his own." We examined the entire house, methodically, so far as we were able, inch by inch. Not another board proved loose. To lift those which were nailed down required tools, and those we were without. We sounded all the walls. With the exception of the party walls, they were the usual lath and plaster constructions, and showed no signs of having been tampered with. The ceilings were intact. If anything was concealed in them, it must have been there some time. The cement was old and dirty. We took the closet to pieces, examined the chimneys, peered into the kitchen oven and the copper. In short, we pried into everything which, with the limited means at our disposal, could be pried into. Without result. At the end, we found ourselves dusty, dirty, and discomfited. The cabman's old gent remained as much a mystery as ever, and no further trace had been discovered of Miss Linden. Atherton made no effort to disguise his chagrin. "Now what's to be done? There seems to be nothing in the place at all, and yet that there is, and that it's the key to the whole confounded business, I should be disposed to swear. In that case, I would suggest that you should stay and look for it. The cabman can go and look for the requisite tools, or a workman to assist you, if you like. For my part, it appears to me that evidence of another sort is, for the moment, of paramount importance, and I propose to commence my search for it by making a call at the house which is over the way. I had observed, on our arrival, that the road only contained 2 houses which were in anything like a finished state. that which we were in, and another some 50 or 60 yards further down on the opposite side. It was to this I referred. The twain immediately proffered their companionship. "I will come with you," said Mr. Lessingham. "And I," echoed Sidney. "We'll leave this sweet homestead in charge of the cabman. I'll pull it to pieces afterwards." He went out and spoke to the driver. "Cabby, we're going to pay a visit to the little crib over there. You keep an eye on this one. And if you see a sign of anyone being about the place, living or dead or anyhow, you give me a yell. I shall be on the lookout, and I'll be with you before you can say Jack Robinson." "You bet I'll yell. I'll raise the hair right off you." The fellow grinned. "But I don't know if you gents are hiring me by the day. I want to change my horse. He ought to have been in his stable a couple of hours ago." "Never mind your horse. Let him rest a couple of hours extra tomorrow to make up for those he has lost today. I'll take care you don't lose anything by this little job, or your horse either. By the way, look here. This will be better than yelling." Taking a revolver out of his trousers pocket, he handed it up to the grinning driver. "If that old gent of yours does appear, you have a pop at him. I shall hear that easier than a yell. You can put a bullet through him if you like. I give you my word it won't be murder." "I don't care if it is," declared the cabman, handling the weapon like one who was familiar with arms of precision. "I used to fancy my revolver shooting when I was with the colors, and if I do get a chance, I'll put a shot through the old hunks, if only to prove to you that I am no liar." Whether the man was in earnest or not, I could not tell, nor whether Atherton meant what he said in answer. "If you shoot him, I'll give you £50. "All right," the driver laughed. "I'll do my best to earn that 50. End of chapter 38. Chapter 39. Miss Louisa Coleman. That the house over the way was tenanted was plain to all the world. At least one occupant sat gazing through the window of the first floor front room. An old woman in a cap. One of those large, old-fashioned caps which our grandmothers used to wear, tied with strings under the chin. It was a bow window, and as she was seated in the bay looking right in our direction, she could hardly have failed to see us as we advanced. Indeed, she continued to stare at us all the while with placid calmness. Yet I knocked once, twice, and yet again without the slightest notice of being taken of my summons. Sidney gave expression to his impatience in his own peculiar vein. "Knockers in this part of the world seem intended for ornament only. Nobody seems to pay any attention to them when they're used. The old lady upstairs must be either deaf or dotty." He went out into the road to see if she was still there. "She's looking at me as calmly as you please. What does she think we're doing here, I wonder? Playing a tune on her front door by way of a little amusement? Madame!" He took off his hat and waved it to her. "Madame, might I observe that if you won't condescend to notice that we're here, your front door will run the risk of being severely injured. She don't care for me any more than if I was nothing at all. Sound another tattoo upon that knocker. Perhaps she's so deaf that nothing short of a cataclysmal uproar will reach her auditory nerves." She immediately proved, however, that she was nothing of the sort. Hardly had the sounds of my further knocking died away than, throwing up the window, she thrust out her head and addressed me in a fashion which, under the circumstances, was as unexpected as it was uncalled for. "Now, young man, you needn't be in such a hurry," Sidney explained. "Pardon me, madame. It's not so much a hurry we're in as pressed for time. This is a matter of life and death." She turned her attention to Sidney, speaking with a frankness for which I imagine he was unprepared. "I don't want none of your imperence, young man. I've seen you before. You've been hanging about here the whole day long, and I don't like the looks of you, and so I'll let you know. That's my front door, and that's my knocker. I'll come down and open when I like, but I'm not going to be hurried, and if the knocker's so much as touched again, I won't come down at all." She closed the window with a bang. Sidney seemed divided between mirth and indignation. "That's a nice old lady, on my honor, one of the good old crusty sort. Agreeable characters this neighborhood seems to grow. A sojourn hereabouts should do one good. Unfortunately, I don't feel disposed just now to stand and kick my heels in the road." Again, saluting the old dame by raising his hat, he shouted to her at the top of his voice. "Madame, I beg 10,000 pardons for troubling you, but this is a matter in which every second is of vital importance. Would you allow me to ask you one or two questions?" Up went the window, out came the old lady's head. "Now, young man, you needn't put yourself out to holler at me. I won't be hollered at. I'll come down and open that door in 5 minutes by the clock on my mantelpiece, and not a moment before." The fiat delivered, down came the window. Sidney looked rueful. He consulted his watch. "I don't know what you think, Champnell, but I really doubt if this comfortable creature can tell us anything worth waiting another 5 minutes to hear. We mustn't let the grass grow under our feet, and time is getting on." I was of different opinion, and said so. "I'm afraid, Atherton, that I can't agree with you. She seems to have noticed you hanging about all day, and it is at least possible that she has noticed a good deal which would be well worth our hearing. What more promising witness are we likely to find? Her house is the only one which overlooks the one we have just quitted. I am of opinion that it may not only prove well worth our while to wait 5 minutes, but also that it would be as well, if possible, not to offend her, by the way. She's not likely to afford us the information we require if you do." "Good. If that's what you think, I'm sure I'm willing to wait. Only it's to be hoped that that clock upon her mantelpiece moves quicker than its mistress." Presently, when about a minute had gone, he called to the cabman. "Seen a sign of anything?" The cabman shouted back, "Ne'er sign. You'll hear a sound of popguns when I do." Those 5 minutes did seem long ones, but at last Sidney, from his post of vantage in the road, informed us that the old lady was moving. "She's getting up. She's leaving the window. Let's hope to goodness she's coming down to open the door. That's been the longest 5 minutes I've known." I could hear uncertain footsteps descending the stairs. They came along the passage. The door was opened, on the chain. The old lady peered at us through an aperture of about 6 inches. "I don't know what you young men think you're after, but have all three of you in my house, I won't. I'll have him and you." A skinny finger was pointed to Lessingham and me. Then it was directed towards Atherton. "But have him, I won't. So if it's anything particular you want to say to me, you'll just tell him to go away." On hearing this, Sidney's humility was abject. His hat was in his hand, he bent himself double. "Suffer me to make you a million apologies, madame, if I have in any way offended you. Nothing, I assure you, could have been farther from my intention or from my thoughts." "I don't want none of your apologies, and I don't want none of you neither. I don't like the looks of you, and so I tell you. Before I let anybody into my house, you'll have to sling your hook." The door was banged in our faces. I turned to Sidney. "The sooner you go, the better it will be for us. You can wait for us over the way." He shrugged his shoulders and groaned, half in jest, half in earnest. "If I must, I suppose I must. It's the first time I've been refused admittance to a lady's house in all my life. What have I done to deserve this thing? If you keep me waiting long, I'll tear that infernal den to pieces." He sauntered across the road, viciously kicking the stones as he went. The door reopened. "Has that other young man gone?" "He has." "Then now, I'll let you in. Have him inside my house, I won't." The chain was removed. Lessingham and I entered. Then the door was refastened and the chain replaced. Our hostess showed us into the front room of the ground floor. It was sparsely furnished and not too clean. But there were chairs enough for us to sit upon, which she insisted on our occupying. "Sit down, do. I can't abide to see folks standing. It gives me the fidgets." So, as soon as we were seated, without any overture on our parts, she plunged in medias res. "I know what it is you've come about, I know. You want me to tell you who it is as lives in the house over the road? Well, I can tell you, and I dare bet a shilling that I'm about the only one who can." I inclined my head. "Indeed, is that so, madam?" She was huffed at once. "Don't madame me, I can't bear none of your lip service. I'm a plain-spoken woman, that's what I am, and I like other people's tongues to be as plain as mine. My name's Miss Louisa Coleman, but I'm generally called Miss Coleman. I'm only called Louisa by my relatives. Since she was apparently between 70 and 80, and looked every year of her apparent age, I deemed that possible. Miss Coleman was evidently a character. If one was desirous of getting information out of her, it would be necessary to allow her to impart in it her own manner. To endeavor to induce her to impart it in anybody else's would be time clean wasted. We had Sydney's fate before our eyes. She started with a sort of roundabout preamble. This property is mine. It was left me by my uncle, the late George Henry Jobson. He's buried in Hammersmith Cemetery just over the way. He left me the whole of it. It's one of the finest building sites near London, and it increases in value every year. And I'm not going to let it for another 20, by which time the value will have more than trebled. So, if that is what you've come about, as heaps of people do, you might have saved yourselves the trouble. I keep the board standing just to let people know that the ground is to let. Though, as I say it, it won't be for another 20 years, when it'll be for the erection of high-class mansions only. Same as there in Grosvenor Square. No shops or public houses, and none of your shanties. I live in this place just to keep an eye on the property. And as for the house over the way, I've never tried to let it, and it never has been let, not until a month ago, when one morning I had this letter. You can see it if you like. She handed me a greasy envelope, which she fettered out of a capacious pocket, which was suspended from her waist, and which she had to lift up her skirt to reach. The envelope was addressed in unformed characters, Miss Louisa Coleman, the Rhododendrons, Convolvulus Avenue, High Oaks Park, West Kensington. I felt, if the writer had not been of a humorous turn of mind, and drawn on his imagination, and this really was the lady's correct address, and there must be something in a name. The letter within was written in the same straggling, characterless calligraphy. I should have said, had I been asked offhand, that the whole thing was the composition of a servant girl. The composition was about on a par with the writing. The undersigned would be obliged if Miss Coleman would let her empty house. I do not know the rent, but sent £50. If more, will send. Please address, Mohammed El Kier, Post Office, Sligo Street, London. It struck me as being as singular an application for a tenancy as I remember to have encountered. When I passed it on to Lessingham, he seemed to think so too. This is a curious letter, Miss Coleman. So I thought, and still more so when I found the £50 inside. There were 5 £10 notes, all loose, and the letter not even registered. If I had been asked what was the rent of the house, I should have said, at the most, not more than £20, because between you and me, it wants a good bit of doing up, and is hardly fit to live in as it stands. I had had sufficient evidence of the truth of this altogether, apart from the landlady's frank admission. Why, for all he could have done to help himself, I might have kept the money, and only sent him a receipt for a quarter. And some folks would have done, but I'm not one of that sort myself, and shouldn't care to be. So I sent this here party, I never could pronounce his name and never shall, a receipt for a year. Miss Coleman paused to smooth her apron and consider. Well, the receipt should have reached this here party on the Thursday morning, as it were. I posted it on the Wednesday night, and on the Thursday after breakfast, I thought I'd go over the way to see if there were any little thing I could do, because there wasn't hardly a whole pane of glass in the place, when I all but went all of a heap. When I looked across the road, blessed if the party wasn't in already, at least as much as he ever was in, which, so far as I can make out, never as being anything particular, though how he got in, unless it was through a window in the middle of the night, is more than I should care to say. There was nobody in the house when I went to bed, that I could pretty nearly take my Bible oath. Yet, there was the blind up at the parlor, and what's more, it was down. And it's been down pretty nearly ever since. Well, I says to myself, for right down imperence, this beats anything. Why, he's in the place before he knows if I'll let him have it. Perhaps he thinks I haven't got a word to say in the matter, £50 or no £50. I'll soon show him. So I slips on my bonnet, and I walks over the road, and I hammers at the door. Well, I've seen people hammering since then, many a one, and how they've kept it up has puzzled me. For an hour, some of them. But I was the first one as begun it. I hammers and I hammers and I kept on hammering, but it wasn't no more use than if I'd been hammering at a tombstone. So I starts rapping at the window, but that wasn't no use neither. So I goes round behind and I hammers at the back door. But there I couldn't make anyone hear nohow. So I says to myself, perhaps the party as is in ain't in a manner of speaking. But I'll keep an eye on the house. And when he is in, I'll take care that he ain't out again before I've had a word to say. So I come back home, and as I said I would, I kept an eye on the house the whole of that livelong day. But never a soul went either out or in. But the next day, which it was a Friday, I got out of bed about 5 o'clock to see if it was raining, through my having an idea of taking a little excursion if the weather was fine, when I see a party coming down the road. He had on one of them dirty-colored bedcover sort of things, and it was wrapped all over his head and round his body like, as I've been told them there Arabs wear. And indeed, I've seen them in them myself at West Brompton, when they was in that exhibition there. It was quite fine and broad day, and I see him as plainly as I see you. He comes skimming along at a tear of a pace, pulls up at the house over the way, opens the front door and lets himself in. So I says to myself, there you are. Well, Mr. Arab, or whatever, or whoever you may be, I'll take good care that you don't go out again before you've had a word from me. I'll show you that landladies have their rights, like other Christians in this country, however it may be in yours. So I kept an eye on the house to see that he didn't go out again. And nobody never didn't. And between 7 and 8, I goes and I knocks at the door, because I thought to myself that the earlier I was, the better it might be. If you'll believe me, no more notice was taken of me than if I was one of the dead. I hammers and I hammers till my wrist was aching. I dare say I hammered 20 times. And then I went round to the back door and I hammers at that. But it wasn't the least good in the world. I was that provoked to think I should be treated as if I was nothing and nobody by a dirty foreigner who went about in a bedgown through the public streets, that it was all I could do to hold myself. I comes round to the front again and I starts hammering at the window with every knuckle on my hands, and I calls out, I'm Miss Louisa Coleman, and I'm the owner of this house, and you can't deceive me. I saw you come in and you're in now, and if you don't come and speak to me at this moment, I'll have the police. All of a sudden, when I was least expecting it, and was hammering my very hardest at the pane, up goes the blind and up goes the window, too. And the most awful-looking creature ever I heard of, not to mention seeing, puts his head right into my face. It was more like a hideous baboon than anything else, let alone a man. I was struck all of a heap and plumps down on the little wall, and all but tumbles head over heels backwards. And he starts shrieking, in a sort of kind of English, and in such a voice as I'd never heard the like. It was like a rusty steam engine. Go away, go away. I don't want you. I will not have you, never. You have your 50 pounds, you have your money. That is the whole of you. That is all you want. You come to me no more, never, never no more, or you be sorry. Go away. I did go away, and that as fast as ever my legs would carry me. What with his looks, and what with his voice, and what with the way that he went on, I was nothing but a mass of trembling. As for answering him back, or giving him a piece of my mind as I had meant to, I wouldn't have done it not for 1,000 pounds. I don't mind confessing, between you and me, that I had to swallow 4 cups of tea right straight away before my nerves were steady. Well, I says to myself, when I did feel as it might be a little more easy, you never have let that house before, and now you've let it with a vengeance, so you have. If that there new tenant of yours isn't the greatest villain that ever went unhung, it must be because he's got near relations, what's as bad as himself. Because 2 families like his, I'm sure there can't be. A nice sort of Arab party to have sleeping over the road, he is. But after a time, I cools down, as it were, because I'm one of them sort as likes to see on both sides of a question. After all, I says to myself, he has paid his rent, and 50 pounds is 50 pounds. I doubt if the whole house is worth much more. And he can't do much damage to it, whatever he does. I shouldn't have minded, so far as that went, if he'd set fire to the place, for between ourselves, it's insured for a good bit over its value. So I decided that I'd let things be as they were, and see how they went on. But from that hour to this, I've never spoken to the man, and never wanted to, and wouldn't, not of my own free will, not for a shilling a time. That face of his will haunt me if I live till Noah, as the saying is. I've seen him going in and out at all hours of the day and night. That Arab party's a mystery if ever there was one. He always goes tearing along as if he's flying for his life. Lots of people have come to the house, all sorts of kinds, men and women. They've been mostly women and even little children. I've seen them hammer and hammer at the front door, but never one have I seen let in, or yet seen taken any notice of, and I think I may say, and yet tell no lie, that I've scarcely took my eye off the house since he's been inside it. Over and over again in the middle of the night have I got up to have a look, so that I've not missed much that has took place. What's puzzled me is the noises that's come from the house. Sometimes for days together there's been not a sound. It might have been a house of the dead. And then, all through the night, there have been yells and screeches, squawks and screams. I never heard nothing like it. I've thought, and more than once, that the devil himself must be in that front room, let alone all the rest of his demons. And as for cats, where they've come from, I can't think. I didn't used to notice hardly a cat in the neighborhood till that there Arab party came. And there isn't much to attract them. But since he came here, there's been regiments. Sometimes at night, there's been troops about the place, screeching like mad. I've wished them farther, I can tell you. That Arab party must be fond of them. I've seen them inside the house at the windows, upstairs and downstairs, as it seems to me, a dozen at a time. End of chapter 39.